Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, and ready to start up episode number 843 by my count. We've been cruising along and very happy to be recording here in our time at the end of January. A nice brisk day, at least where I am, but I've got two brothers from the Atlanta, Georgia area. Much nicer, warmer down there. I kind of wish I was there. But let me introduce to you first. We have with us one person who is certainly no stranger to Christ the Center. We have Dr. Carlton Wynn, Associate Pastor of Westminster PCA there in Atlanta, Georgia, who also teaches a bit at RTS Atlanta. Welcome back, Carlton. So good to see you, brother.
Thank you, Camden. It's great to be here. Also great to be with Dr. Hall.
Absolutely. And that is our special guest today. We're very excited and pleased to have with us Dr. David Hall, who serves as senior pastor of Midway Presbyterian Church in Powder Springs, Georgia. Welcome, David. It's good to see you as well.
Hi, Camden, Carlton. Great to see you guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. We're really excited about this. Got plenty to talk about, and we're going to get into all that. The main point of discussion today is a new book, Irony and the Presbyterian Church in America, written by our guest today, Dr. David W. Hall. We're going to be speaking about the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, which just on December 4th celebrated its 50th anniversary. So little brothers or little sister, depending on how we talk about it, is coming along well, at least from the OPC's perspective. Little brother almost absorbed big brother a few times. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. I know I've been coming to the PCA General Assembly just for the last several years, and I intend to come every year in the foreseeable future. And it was just such a joy for me to read this book, and I'm looking forward to talking about that today. I might preempt that discussion briefly. Carlton, maybe if you could talk a bit and then lead on into David, maybe speaking about the Reformation Worship Conference, because I know when you were out here, Carlton, teaching a course, we got to talk quite a bit about that and how much of a joy and a tradition that is. Maybe we could share a bit more information about that with our listeners.
Yeah, I want David to speak to that conference and its genesis and how it's been going. Let me just say, by way of preface, that I've known David for a few years now, a number of years. I've known of him for many years, ever since he kind of took the helm of the Calvin 500 anniversary publications and all of that. And David doesn't know I'm going to say this, but I just want to convey to readers my appreciation for him in particular ways. David, I've watched over the years serve the church in many ways, but especially as a gatherer of friends. He delights to coordinate dinners and gatherings where other friends get to meet other friends. And then perhaps most amazingly, David often kind of, forgive me, brother, but kind of retreats into the background and just lets people enjoy getting to know one another. And I just have always appreciated that about you, David, and I've been privileged to be in your home and be a participant in some of those gatherings at General Assembly, and just your heart for fellowship among brothers in the Lord. And so I know you love the church, you love our denomination, and you love it when friends meet friends, which is a delight, and it's been a blessing to me. So, yeah, David, can you talk to us about the Reformation Worship Conference, where a lot of fellowship happens? How did that start? How's it going? What are your thoughts on its future?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. We hosted the first Reformation Worship Conference here at our church. We're in suburban Atlanta, Northwest. Carlton's sort of east or northeast Atlanta area. In 2010, and we wrote for a grant that was actually approved by the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship in Grand Rapids, which is, we don't always agree with everything that comes out of there, but we received a grant and had our first conference, and one of our keynoters was Dr. Hughes Old, and that led to a growing group. I think we had maybe 125, 150 people max, and that would include church members. So talk about a small niche conference. That was it. And some of the principal founders were Terry Johnson, who I know was on your show recently, Mark Ross, Dr. Old, myself, and we just thought there needed to be something positive in Reform circles that accentuated the beauty and value of historic Reformed worship. I'll tell you a sub-story. I came to Christ in 1972 in the Jesus Movement, and was nothing but actually I was a Methodist by birth and then a parachurch Christian. I went to LaBrie in 1976, and that led me then to Covenant Seminary beginning fall of 76. And while I was at Covenant Seminary, there were many unintended things that happened, but one of the most lasting influences and unsought after by me was taking a course on worship by Dr. Robert G. Rayburn. Dr. Rayburn Sr. was the president of Covenant. He taught us Reformed worship. And it was an eye-opener because at that time, in my experience, there was no strong middle in Protestant worship. It was sort of the right-wing, contemporary, charismatic, rather experiential-based and untested and not really thought about. And then on the other hand the other extreme was a highly liturgical, think Anglican, Roman Catholic Church, and nothing in between. In Dr. Rayburn's tutelage, many of us in that generation learned that there was a wonderful, strong middle within Protestant worship. And Reformed theology was actually the fountain of that, and that worship services were to take the best of the two poles that our Lord spoke of in John 4:23, spirit and truth. And so all my life as a pastor, I have sought to implement those things. And we realized that there was a dearth of this, call it strong middle, traditional Reformed Protestant worship, particularly in the PCA. And I was telling somebody just recently, I am proud to say that I made and created Terry Johnson as a celebrity author. Terry's unpublished, and in 1995, a small publisher that I ran out of our church in Tennessee published his book Leading in Worship, which Terry will be embarrassed. I'll tell you the story, but your audience will like it. We initially turned the manuscript down. Terry sent me this unsolicited manuscript, which is now Leading in Worship. I read through it and I said, yeah, ho-hum. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nothing new here. Everybody knows this. And having been taught fairly well, I said, well, you know, why are we going to publish something that everybody already knows?
Right.
Meanwhile, I had a ruling elder on the board who overseen that publisher, who's a physician. He was semi-retired. He traveled to Florida. His name is Tom Lynch. He'd be glad to be mentioned. He came stomping into my office one day. He said, Pastor, where's that book? Do you know what worship is like in the PCA? And I said, well, no, Tom, actually, I don't. I don't get out much. I'm here as your pastor every Sunday, so I don't get around. But I kind of know what you're talking about. And he said, we have got to publish something on worship because the worship in PCA churches in an unnamed state, and let's just say in the southeast United States where Ron DeSantis is governor, is terrible. And I said, okay, I'll look at it again. Looked at it again. We published it. And that really led to a great career of Terry as an author. He's, wow. He's become fabulously wealthy from all his books. and it's still in print. We gave up the copyright to somebody else in the mid-2000s. But nonetheless, the point is this. Normal people want good worship. So when we started, zoom forward, we started the Reformation Worship Conference in 2010, we tried to light a candle, to use a phrase, instead of curse the darkness. So instead of being a critical group who spent most of his time polemicizing about bad worship forms, which we do a little bit of, to be honest, notwithstanding, we thought, let's do something positive. Let's have Dr. Old in. So Dr. Old was beginning to fade. But he was with us for three or four of our earliest conferences. Mark Ross from Columbia, South Carolina, is a wonderful man, was a mainstay. And over the years, the conference grew. Some of our own people began to come. And by just before COVID, we had reached an all-time attendance of maybe 350.
Wow.
Which for us was big.
Yeah.
And then COVID hit. And Cameron, you probably don't know this, but we had the outline for the first Machen conference. We were going to do Machen. We were going to do Machen in 2022.
Yeah. Preempt so everyone.
We had the outline for that because we could also tie it to his early lectures.
Yeah.
Remember, his lectures actually occurred in the churches in 1922. So we were going to do that, but COVID got us another year. I'm sorry, that was 2021. We're going to do that. And then 2022, we had like a riot and a coup in our church, so we couldn't do anything. Yeah. So that's just truth in advertising. And so when we came back and relaunched the conference in 2023 with many of the same participants, Terry Johnson, Neil Stewart had become a regular. Carlton has been Carlton's a breath of fresh air, young, bright scholar who people really realize there's some depth. That we advertised him as just a pretty face. He's much more than that.
Yeah.
Carl Truman has become a regular. And so the conference wildly exceeded
our Carl focus, Truman, also a pretty face.
Katrina is wonderful. She's fabulous.
That's great.
Carl he's a beautiful man.
Yeah.
Let's be dishonest. So we had, and Lord's blessing, we had about 500 people, and it was our best conference. A lot of fellowship, as Carlton said. We do something that the conferences, once they outgrow a couple hundred, we have meals in our church. And one of my colleagues in ministry, who's with another big ministry, said, "Don't do that. It's a waste of time." We did it, and now he loves it. A lot of fellowship, a lot of mentoring. You come to our conference and you can sit at a table and have dinner with Bob Godfrey or Hughes Old or David Gordon or Carlton Wynn or Carl Truman. We don't give our speakers green rooms. They don't have limos that drop them off. They're part of the conference. And it really is unique, I think, in that sense. So we reached an agreement about a year ago with the Independent Presbyterian Church in Savannah, where Terry's pastored for 300-400 years. And we're going to now alternate sites. It's a home and away series, if you want to think of it in terms of college sports. So this year, October 10 through 13, we're having the same conference, a lot of the same personnel, some changes, but we will be hosted in the wonderful venue of the Independent Presbyterian Church. And they're already, I think just last week, they already put something up on the Twitter account, RefCon Worship. At RefCon War, something like that.
Yeah.
So the dates are out there. We'll have more details. We do have some great speakers, some of our normals, and Terry has attracted a few others that are closer to the East Coast, one of whom is A.C.B. Charles, who will be preaching, Kevin DeYoung. I think Ian Hamilton is coming over from the U.K., along with some other clunkers who normally inhabit the conference. And then next year we'll be back here. 2025, we're back here. So we're very excited about the partnership with IPC. It's a great fit. We're contributing all of our resource, any of our processes to them, and they'll help out. So I commend that to your listenership.
Yeah. We'll certainly put links in the episode description and let everyone know. I'm very excited about that myself. Looking forward to that, and to encourage everyone to follow up and get down there. But this is a tremendous event. And definitely a worthwhile topic and theme, so we're excited to promote that and hope more people would come to a better understanding of a biblical form of worship. And thanks for putting that on. Looking forward to it.
Yep.
Looking to our topic today, in addition to all that, of course, we have the book before us, Irony and the Presbyterian Church in America. Thank you, David, for sending me a copy. I'm really excited to speak about this and got through it all. I can't say I'm going to remember every detail, but it's not that kind of book. You get the wide sweep, and it's something you can refer to quite often. This is a history of the PCA in a sense, but it's different from others. And then I've got questions. I'd love to have a conversation about this, but just to let the listeners and viewers know, in many ways, it's a history that's organized through the lens of each General Assembly. So it's not just GA reports. There is reflection. There is looking at the history of the denomination through decade lenses, or sometimes 2 or 3 year lenses when there are important themes that are happening and playing out. But in general, it works through and marches through each successive General Assembly, which I thought was fascinating. And I haven't spoken with my committee at the OPC committee for the historian, but I wonder we'd have 88, 89 of them to do, but I wonder if we might end up writing something ourselves very similar to this method. But with that precy in place, that preface, I suppose, David, could you tell us about your decision to start up and take up this work and how, you know, what was in your mind as you were thinking about how you might approach it methodologically, organizationally, or however else?
Sure. Two things, I guess, come to mind. And Camden, if you don't remember all the facts, I won't either, but I do have a copy. So we, between us, we can maybe
we can look them up,
be fairly close to the truth. All last year, we all knew the 50th birthday party for the PCA was coming. And I really feared that it would be a one big session of patting ourselves on the back. I figured that it would be triumphalistic and glorifying of all of the heroism of the PCA and just a lot of self-aggrandizement, which many of these things are. So I said, let's have another voice in this. And as sometimes I'm known to do, was happy to assume a contrarian's role. And I said, the second thing is I happen to have participated in about 40 of the 50 General Assemblies. And just because of the period of my life, I was an eyewitness of sorts to many of those, served on committees, served on commissions, was involved in a number of different things. And I developed a practice in the mid to late 80s. Of writing up the General Assembly every year. Mm. This is back before the internet. This is when I would send out mimeographed things, typed and, you know, printed out in envelopes. So I had those, and I didn't recover all of them because, be honest, the software was so old. I think it was back in, you know, maybe a different software altogether. But I had a lot of these on my hard drive. So I just started thinking, well, what if someone were to set his hand to telling the story of the PCA as an eyewitness, admittedly, let's be Vantillians. There's presuppositional biases all throughout my book. I actually try to articulate them at the end of the introduction. So I am a very, very solid Vantillian, and none of us are neutral toward facts, and none of us are strictly scientific or objective. So let's admit it. I at least admit that some others are not as quick to do that. So I said, what if we were to set our hand and do that? And I realized, hey, I've probably got 40 short essays. I could go back and review the assembly minutes on the first 10 where I was not present, mm-hmm. But knew some of the participants and put it together. So I started working on that for about a year. Wow. Knew it was coming. Kept it quiet. My wife vowed me to silence. My wife tells me I really get myself in trouble with denominational politics about any time I say anything. And so she didn't, and didn't know about the book until it was out.
Oh no.
And she found out from a friend, and it was a little uncomfortable. But she actually liked it. She doesn't read most of my books. She actually read it, Carlton. So. That was to me a very encouraging thing. Any reviews don't matter if Anne will read the book. So it's a review, and it's not detailed. It's thematic, selective review of what I think were the most important and formative moments in each assembly. There's some of the chapters are uneven. Some of the sections, mm-hmm. There are a couple in the mid to late 90s where I think some very important things were happening that are longer. So all of these are not necessarily the same length. But I think it tells the story of the PCA. I think it tells the story of the PCA fairly. I think it's honest. It's not triumphalistic. And we do, I do admit that we're far from perfect.
Mm. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I loved reading it. That's really helpful for me to hear in terms of how it started with many of your annual write-ups of the General Assembly makes sense of putting them together. But I think that adds, whether it was intended or not, an interesting approach where we don't find that kind of approach necessarily in other books. I'm wondering how might you relate this? Now, it's got its own purpose, its own voice. It's intentionally done so. So it's not trying to be an official history, an authorized history. It's not trying to capture everyone's view and perspective necessarily. Nevertheless, what are some other histories of the PCA? I'm thinking especially of maybe Sean Michael Lucas's recent volume. And how would you find this particular book situated among them, adding another voice?
Well, the first, it wouldn't be called a history, but it should be treated as such. The first history of the PCA would be Morton Smith's How the Gold Has Become Dim, which actually was his apologetic for the foundation of the PCA. And then there were basically a few memories. Kennedy Smart did a book in 1998. I think it's entitled, I've got it over here somewhere, I Remember, or is that right? I've got it listed somewhere. And there was a coffee table book released in 1998 at the 25th anniversary by Paul Settle, which was aesthetically pleasing and, you know, certainly was not meant to be a detailed history. Frank J. Smith did a history in one of our predecessor denominations. Of course, there are a number of histories of the OPC. We're thankful for that. And by the way, Camden, you do a fabulous job. So nice to have a historian. And again, I have to say, I have the highest respect, gratitude, and praise for Wayne Sparkman.
Oh, he's tremendous.
At the PCA Historical Center. I've known Wayne for a long time before he did that even. And he is just a gem. In fact, when we were in St. Louis, Carlton, I don't know if you were with us or not, but a couple of years ago, we got an underground tour of the Historical Center by Wayne. Nice. And some of our elders went, and it was really, really great to see that resource. But so we have some histories. And then Sean Lucas wrote his book. I think it was timed. It was supposed to be for the 40th anniversary of the PCA. But the PCA, in what might or might not be our typical form, celebrated the 40th anniversary at our 42nd General Assembly. So yeah. Maybe you could say, I wouldn't, of course, as a PCA minister, but maybe someone at OPC could say, PCA is always 2 years late. But Sean wrote that book, and he spent some time doing it. It's a very different kind of book. I reread it about a year ago, and came away with an even greater appreciation for his work. It's different in tone, different in style, very well written. His prose is far better than mine. But all of those books I mentioned, all of those books seek to explain 1973. And what I tried to do in this book was explain 2023. So I always had an eye toward, okay, here's what the PCA did in any particular years, but here's where it is. So rather than explaining our formation and indeed most of the celebration events at our General Assembly last June, went back to 1973. And that has its place. But I don't know anybody who's really written a sustained history of 1973 to the present. So that was one way to try to approach it and understand it.
David, I really enjoyed diving into this book as a PCA guy, just seeing the names and the issues that I and just the debates that transpired long before I sort of entered officially into the PCA. It was just it's a wealth of detail and information and background that really, I think, contextualizes more contemporary debates very helpfully. For those of those listeners that haven't seen the table of contents, David has chosen a little, I don't know, what do you call it, nickname or subtitle for every General Assembly. So just looking at the table of contents, 1973, you title beginning, but then, you know, 1977, still culture warriors, 78, preparing for union, 79, rise of oligarchy. So some of these have a little bit of tongue in cheek. And then you get to one of my favorites is 1998, a St. Louis home run ? Because, you know, Mark McGuire was chasing Roger Maris. So there's humor built into some of these taglines. And 2001, personalities or principles. maybe I can take that as a launch pad for a question for you, David. The title of the book is Irony and the Presbyterian Church in America. I'd love for you, broad scale, okay, don't hold back. Why did you pick the word irony and the theme of irony as a kind of lens or theme that you keep coming back to? What are you trying to say when it comes to irony and the PCA?
Shorter answer. My friend David Gordon received a copy, read it, and David lived through most of this simultaneously as I did. In recent correspondence, Carlton, since our conference, you know, he was here. David's at Grove City mm-hmm. as well with Carlton. He said, yeah, there you should write a chapter on irony every year. For example, when higher courts disregard the lower courts or do not pay adequate deference to the lower courts, which is one of my hot button issues, but let's please don't get into that. But when that happens, one of the mantras for the formation of PCA my first 20, 30 years was we're a grassroots denomination. So it became a joke. You OPC guys laugh at us all the time because we always refer to ourselves as a bottoms up Presbyterian church. And I think there have been some racy cartoons drawing that. So there's an irony in which the PCA started to be a very decentralized, very bottoms up grassroots Presbyterian church. And yet, in a fairly short amount of time, we've established as much bureaucracy as any other denomination could in a short time. So the bureaucrats in the PCA, and they don't like being called that, but sometimes I don't like being called what I am. But the bureaucrats in the PCA are very involved in a lot of things, and to me that's the opposite ethos of the founding of the PCA. Now, maybe we need all that bureaucracy. I mean, the PCA is a $200 million enterprise right now. If you add together the annual budgets of all of our agencies, $200 million, which came to, I don't know how it is with you, but here in Georgia, which that's a pretty big nickel. You could buy a lot of stuff for that. So it's ironic in a sense that we have that much wealth, that much sway, that many people. And how are we using that? So I as well as being a participant, I also did want to hold our denomination to a fair standard of what we might refer to as global Reformed theology and practice. So we're subject to those norms as well. This is not an America First book. It's not a book that says the Presbyterian Church in America is automatically does things the best way. I got the title from a Martin Marty book. Marty, you've Chicago history professor in the mid 80s, wrote a 4-volume series on 20th century American religion. And one of his volumes, the first one was The Irony of It All. So for years, at that time, as a fairly young pastor, that just shaped me. I thought, my goodness, because Marty's thesis was, watch, and lo and behold, a lot of what ecclesiastical organizations profess to begin with, eventually move away from. A secular analog would be, think for example, of the Ford Foundation or the Carnegie Foundation, or recently in the news, Harvard institutions that were founded for certain purposes that have strayed far from those. And Marty made the point that this force of irony, which, as you remember, is part of an ancient Greek tragedy. There's comedy, there's history, and then there's irony. And I think we're sometimes unaware of it. When I thought of using that as a rubric with a side dish of Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society, it seemed to give me a platform on which I could honestly give my opinions and not accuse any of our leaders of being bad men or bad characters or you know, silly or anything like that. But many times we're unaware of some of the things we're contributing to.
Yeah, that's very helpful. As I finished the book this morning, I read it as a kind of call to self-awareness. in humility before the Lord. You're right. Irony in Greek tragedy and in literature refers to situations that are not apparent to the characters but are to the readers, or things that are expected or not as they seem to be. And it's a reminder to us that in the warp and woof and course of a denomination's life, you know, the participants don't always have a healthy dose of self-awareness or even humility or commitment to the founding principles in all of their consistency as they might otherwise, we might hope.
Well, let me just interrupt. Like one thing, I stumbled on a comment I made to a group last summer, to a group of elders here at our church, and I talked about how we keep repeating the same errors. And it was to largely a group of young men who are future leaders. And I said, I'm old enough to have lived through most of the mistakes and errors we're recommitting. And if you're not that old, you could at least study history.
Mm-hmm.
But one way or another, let's don't just keep committing the same mistakes. And yet most of us do.
Mm-hmm. And there might be listeners out there who are thinking, okay, I'm not in the PCA, or maybe there are some young guys in the PCA and they're saying, what exactly is Dr. Hall talking about? I mean, as I read your book, the things that come to my mind are an acceleration of bureaucratic mechanisms and top-down decision-making that is at odds with the organic lower court functioning. There is the tendency toward theological loosening for the sake of ecumenical union. There is often, you come back to use one of our agencies, MTW, Mission to the World, and how do we think about missions in light of the mission of the church? You talk about the way in which godly men can end up becoming enamored with caucusing and political agendas in a way that leads them to act in ways that you wouldn't otherwise expect godly men to act. Am I missing themes? Am I striking the themes that you're trying to hit as you evaluate the ups and downs of all the General Assemblies for 50 years?
No, I thank you for that summary. I think it's a very accurate summary. You know, if there are young men who don't know the PCA, just think of this as an outlaw history. Camden used the phrase unauthorized. It's unauthorized, to be sure.
Yeah.
It's, and I say up front, it's not meant to be a revisionistic history that champions a department or an agency or a mission group or any part of the PCA. It's one person's take, and everybody else could write their own 400-page book if they'd like to. And I would welcome that. So, you know, I think that story needs to be told, and I do hope, Carlton, I think you're right, I hope it's seen as a precautionary tale. I think the biggest danger that we have at PCA, I am not of the opinion that, you know, we're close to apostatizing or denying the faith. We often hear, even from the most progressive elements in the PCA, that, you know, nobody here is arguing for gay marriage or anything like that. So I don't think the PCA has committed theological error. However, over my last probably 5 to 10 years of my life as an observer and participant, and as a regular, just an ordinary pastor, I think there's a subtle danger from the managerial culture that could be more damaging to us long-term than any theological error that we've dealt with. So I think that's something to be on our toes about. I think the founders of the PCA in 1973, because of what they fought through, I think they were a little bit more in touch with what I think a church should be and will last longer being. So people forget, like I said, I've lived through this, and you can get these pieces of information one of two ways: either be as old as I am and live through it and make mistakes, or you can just simply read history. But people don't remember that the PCA was formed and they were so anti-decentralization. And Sean Lucas points this out in broad stroke, not the specifics that I do, but they were so anti-decentralization that they would not allow the four beginning permanent committees to even be located in the same city.
Right.
So they eventually moved to Carlton's neighborhood in the mid-80s. Got an office building then, and now they're in North. And again, some of these are very good friends, longstanding men I've known, worked with, served with. Brian Chappell and I were in seminary together. He was a year ahead of me. I've known these guys and served with them. But the PCA founders, I think, would look at this and say, "What has happened? If a PCA founder was only present in 1973 at the first General Assembly." And heard those large Thornwellian emphases, whether they knew it was Thornwellianism or not, whether they knew it was a spiritual mission of the church view, or whether they knew all that or not, they agreed and they heartily concurred with those emphases along with the decentralization. I think if a man had gone to that 73 assembly and then sort of died and came back in a wonderful life moment, to 2023, he'd be shocked.
The ghost of Presbyterian future, I guess, could show him what it would look like.
Well, the sad thing is the ghost of Presbyterian future, we've already seen, is the ghost of Presbyterian past.
Right, and you also kind of speak to that a little bit in one perspective, speaking of the figure of Janus, who is a two-faced figure, but you're emphasizing that he's looking both forward and backward. And it can often be a danger to focus on one or the other. So I appreciated that emphasis. I got to that even today. I was reviewing that section of the book. And, you know, certainly in my denomination, there's great tendency because we have such a strong origin story and that forms so much of our denominational identity that we focus so much on 1936 and the events leading up to it. That's such a driver for us. But it can be a danger if we're not also thinking about what that means for us into the future and where we want to go. I'm not saying we are this way, but if the only thing we care about is just, you know, living in 1936, that's not exceedingly helpful. And the same thing for the PCA, you can have some people who are purely, you know, conservatives in the strictest of sense, wanting to retain that Thorwellian emphasis of 1973 with no desire to move forward or to seek the Great Commission in the places and with the people that God has placed us with at the moment. Or you can go the entire other direction and just throw off your history and just try to move forward as some sort of blind progressive. It was interesting for you to lay that out and for me to think about what that actually means in the present day. So just one last thing to mention, that was the thing early on in this very conversation that you emphasized, where many of the other histories, rightfully so, are focused on 1973. But you're also trying to do something that many historians might shy away from because they don't have historical distance. But since you're writing an eyewitness account, it's important also to speak about where the church is right now and where it seems to be going.
Yeah, in the providence of God, I happen to just be sitting in a place, and again, no one in PCA headquarters would or has to approve any of my individual year write-ups or the whole. Thankfully, a number of younger men are picking that up. It's, as you know, Camden and Carlton, it's an age-old practice. Hodge in the mid-19th century Presbyterians, J.B. Adger in the South, and others would. Annually write up their General Assemblies and publish them usually in the Princeton Review or Biblical Repertory. And they're very literate pieces, far more literate than this work. So that's a good tradition. I think people want to hear, you know, again, people, I'm a libertarian in terms of information. It's a free market. People want to hear different opinions. They're mature enough to weigh. People can agree or disagree. And write their own. That would be good. I imagine there's some somebody's probably being paid a lot of money to write a more pro-partisan PCA history.
Hmm. Well, you are very honest.
I made a lot of money. I made like $17.
you were not paid handsomely for this publication.
Right.
Well, you are very honest, both in the history and in your own opinions and perspectives, especially toward the end of the book. I just want to read. Can I just read a section toward the very end of what you say here and then ask you a question? You say, over the various decades, the PCA has grown impressively, sent missionaries, established its own bureaucratic culture, founded campus ministries, planted churches, provided educational materials, inherited both a seminary and a college, and had witnessed to its culture. The Constitution was well established, and there had been no alterations to the Westminster standards during the first 50 years. However, both the RAO canons, that is, rules of assembly operation, and the bureaucratic curve were expansive, and one could not be faulted from wondering if our managerial gold might be dimming. A little throwback to Dr. Smith. And then you say this, while this written history has not closed its eyes to real foibles and failures, it also carries hopefulness and appreciation. There were signal accomplishments, such as the joining and receiving union in 1982, that's with the RPCES, the planting of numerous churches, the bolstering of historic orthodoxy in many congregations, and the discipling of new generations. Hopefully, we can learn from our successes without inordinate hubris and profit from our own mistakes, seeking to avoid the death spiral of mainline liberalized churches. So you strike a balance note there at the end, David, and you're very upfront about this book being a cautionary tale and a warning to future generations and a call to self-consciousness and avoiding pride and politicking in churchly matters. But I'm curious to know your perspective as we see kind of the rampant secularizing of our world, the breakdown of seemingly everything, and distrust in institutions. And yet, to go back to what we said at the beginning, the Reformation Worship Conference is stronger than ever. We see a new generation of young men coming into gospel ministry who are convinced of confessional, ordinary means of grace.
More ruling elders at General Assemblies?
Ruling elder participation. Mm-hmm. Camden loves partying with the ruling elders at PCA General Assembly. So it seems to me, you know, just from the last couple of General Assemblies, and we have to be careful not to make too grandiose deductions from it, but that the PCA is in a stronger place, or perhaps than it's been in the last 10 years. I'm curious to know your thoughts on just your perspective for the future of the PCA.
Yeah, I'm a committed amillennialist. There are ups and downs in history. I try to show that throughout the book. There have been General Assemblies in my life when rather traditional conservatives would leave absolutely moribund and depressed and even start talking about leaving the PCA. Conversely, there have been years when progressive or liberal PCA guys would say, oh, this is terrible, we're done. There are ups and downs. I cannot tell you how many times I've had this exact conversation with friends who would say, well, is this our last General Assembly? And sometimes it seems like it is. Sometimes we have a run of pretty good years. In the late 90s, there was sort of some strong backbone and ruling elder participation. I think Camden mentioned that. And some leadership that led to slow down some forces that were more modernizing. And then there have been other times when there'd be three or four years that were just very, very disappointing. I guess I'm contrarian. I'm not quite as optimistic as some of the younger guys at PCA, who I count as friends, who were saying the PCA is coming back. And we're having great green pastures ahead of us. There have been a couple of good years, and the whole thing with Greg Johnson, I think, catalyzed a number of interested people. And that issue is over. I've had two people in the last week. I was showing my pastor friends at lunch today. I've had two people ask me last week, what's going on in the PCA? And I was stumped. And I said, well, nothing. So we had our big birthday party. We had our big celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Johnson left. And it's tempting to say, ah, everything is good. And so we said, my view, though, is, however, in reality, if you go back to that threatening managerial ethos, nothing has been addressed there.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who I won't mention has the same view I do. He's been around for a long time, and he says, well, let's see if we ever get a real conservative guy elected as a coordinator of an agency.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll see the dawning of the new age. And it's not to say anybody heading an agency is not a conservative, but somebody who's a known, just say a friend of Carlton Wentz, say that way. a known conservative, or somebody who would have lunch with me. you know, if we start seeing those guys as the head of M&A or MTW, which is frankly unthinkable to me. Carlton, you know, we had dinner with Lloyd Kim. Lloyd's a friend. We serve on boards together. I think the world of him and his wife. But in terms of an organization, they're marching to a very different drum than our church's missions committee. And that's certainly their choice, and we have our choices. But so I think that there are institutions in the PCA that will be very resistant to reforming back to more historic patterns. Mm-hmm. They're far more contemporary than a lot of the local churches. My wish for General Assembly, this is not a question, but just to anticipate one, that sometimes my wish for General Assembly is that General Assembly would be made up of the practitioners of ministry. The General Assembly would be a meeting of pastors and members of session who would meet. Now, my friend Carlton's a wonderful academic, gifted writer, a really great theologian. But he's also a pastor. I'd like to hear his voice on anything. Something changes in our lives when we live in the local churches. I have for about 45 years. We think pastorally. We think about things. Sometimes we're more on edge toward certain issues because we've seen them lived out in their implications in our congregation. Some of the people that I knew 7 or 8 years ago who were the most cutting edge on transgender issues were a pastor friend in Asheville, North Carolina, and others long before books were written on that. So sometimes we see things soon. And there's also a kind of a realism, a common sense realism, not to be confused with
Thomas
Reed's view vis-a-vis Hume. But there's a certain realism that we have that we're not a perfect church, and we have to get along and work together. I wish the General Assemblies would spend more time doing that than some of the grandiose visions.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you.
We'd certainly be remiss if I didn't ask you about joining and receiving in the remaining time that we have. That certainly is an important intersection between OPC and PCA history. The details are described within the book, and you can also read about them in the General Assembly and histories of other denominations. But in 82 and 86, 87, there are similar themes that kept coming up, and there was always a push towards an organic union or a merger, a joining and receiving, as it was put, between different denominations. And the PCA eventually did receive the RPCES. And I'm curious what you think about those whole proceedings, as well as perhaps how the denomination changed in whatever way, for the better, for the broadening, or whatever it might be, with the joining of the RPCES, also taking on a denominational seminary, which it did not have prior to that time. But then the three times the PCA and the OPC tried to merge, the PCA declined the OPC at least twice, and we declined the PCA once. So it goes both ways. But what are some of your thoughts on that? And wondered if you could share that.
Well, I think that's a sad chapter. It's a sad chapter in PCA history. I was in St. Louis in the late 70s. So while the JNR was being discussed, my professors were very involved. Don McNair, who headed up what would be M&A, but National Presbyterian Missions for the RPCS, was very involved. Very committed to this. And then Paul Gilchrist at Covenant College was really committed to this. Dr. Rayburn was not as convinced. Some of the other faculty I knew, but the RPCES really wanted to join with the PCA. I was not a Presbyterian at all in those years. I was still a Methodist. So I was ordained in the Southern Church, Southern Presbyterian Church in 1980, and came into the PCA by virtue of JNR. But I think it was a good-hearted effort. I think the original vision, the RPCNA was also a part of that discussion later for some reason. And the ARPs were left out for some reason, get their feelings hurt and weren't ever invited to the party, but were sort of told, you know, you can go to the prom next year maybe. But the PCA did merge with the RPCS. And I think irony is at work. I think one of the things that the PCA was enamored with, and I want you to know, I went to LaBrie and Schaefer was filming How Should We Then Live when I was there.
Wow.
And I went to seminary as a big Schaefer fan.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lasting impact in my life. But I think the PCA was enamored with Francis Schaefer.
Mm.
And I think they thought Francis Schaefer was just the thing we needed. So he was a real influence, I think, in selling the RPCS to the PCA. And somehow it worked. And it was probably his political aura that gave comfort to Southerners as much as anything. And Schaefer was very strong, very bold. The Franz Schaefer you hear quoted at PCA General Assembly came to write this down, keep a log, because you're a lot younger man, you can go to these. The number of times Franz Schaefer is quoted accurately in his context is seldom. He'll be misrepresented and used as a rhetorical wedge to argue for something that was contrary to what he held to.
Mm.
Notwithstanding, Schaefer would be called a culture warrior today.
Yeah.
If we had somebody preaching and teaching the things that Franz Schaefer said, you would say he's a Christian nationalist. Mm. he wasn't, of course, that's anachronistic, but Schaefer was very popular. He mentored some of the PCA men before the PCA was founded. They sought his advice. And I think that greased the skids for the RPCS to come in. The RPCS somehow came to convince the Southerners that they weren't as difficult as I heard them called the Philadelphia lawyers. this is not apocryphal. I heard a leading PCA pastor, I was in Tennessee Valley Presbyterian at the time, on multiple occasions say the OPC is nothing but a bunch of Philadelphia lawyers.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good way to get people turned down in the South.
Yeah. Not
so
attractive.
The PCA looked favorably on the RPCS, not so favorably on the OPC. I thought it was sad that there was never any more clarity. There were some good men who tried. I still think we would all be better off if we were all together. In fact, I share my friend Bob Godfrey's Reformed dream, which both of us know will never happen. But it'd be nice if NAPARC churches could come together on some more cooperative basis. Now, how has that changed us? I'm also, and again, I lived through these things. When I went through Covenant Seminary in the late 1970s and began to think about ordination, I intentionally did not pursue ordination in the RPCS. Carlton, do you know why? Easy. I would have been turned down.
Mm.
I wasn't as strong in the regulative and principle of worship. I wasn't strong in confessional matters. I wasn't a five-point Calvinist. The Midwest Presbytery, the RPCS, was a very strong, very orthodox, very confessional presbytery at that time. And so I sought to be ordained in the liberal denomination in the PCUS to be a conservative evangelical and sought to be a reformer. That being said, I happen to see some strengths in the RPCS tradition that some people in the South don't see. I don't think Covenant Seminary or Covenant College has spoiled the PCA. I think in some ways that's the tail wagging the dog. It's the other way around. I think the driver for change in the PCA, in my opinion, is not always the seminaries. In fact, in the PCA, it's the big steeple churches, and it's our corporate culture of agency coordinators. That's what brings change to the PCA. So I know it's a common trope to say, well, the seminaries always lead a denomination down the path. Again, having been there, I'm just not sure that's really true. The PCAs, whatever mistakes we've made and we'll make, we're making them on our own, not necessarily because of a seminary. And also, in percentage terms, the PCA still has more ministers coming into it from RTS and Westminster Seminary, Westminster, California, and there's a growing number of students from Greenville Seminary than it does ordained men coming in from Covenant Seminary. So I haven't quite been able to persuade myself honestly that that's what's caused things to change. Hmm. A bigger inducement for change, in my opinion, does go back to the First General Assembly. And I think you can see it this way. The Frank Barkers and the Jack Williamsons and many of those who were leaders wanted so desperately to show the PCUS that we were a good church, a valid church, a big church, that they quickly wanted to be a full-service church with everything from a conference center to seminaries, colleges,
right,
retirement plans, annuity programs, everything. And so we wanted to do that. And again, I think that's a normal tendency when people leave a church, even a local church or denomination. They want to say, hey, I was right, and doggone it, we're valid. And so I think what we did was early on we adopted this yin for growth and yin for size. And I think that has driven most of the changes that would concern me for the future, far more than receiving a tradition. The RPCS never would have numbered more than 10-12% of the PCA.
Yeah.
Now, had the OPC come in, that would have been maybe a doubling of that. I don't think there's any real reason why those issues couldn't be revisited.
Mm. Yeah, we're about...
Camden, maybe you have 11 years at the 100th anniversary of the OPC.
That'd be a bad time to ask us. Because the one time where we were invited and we declined was 86, after, because we had celebrated our 50th anniversary and denominational pride and you know, reflection on our heritage was and our identity was so high. I think still a majority of our assembly decided to go ahead with it, but it didn't have the super majority necessary. So we actually did kind of vote ourselves out of existence, kind of.
If you look at the General Assembly minutes, it's clear the votes on that, the Deep South Presbyteries.
Yeah.
The Deep South Presbyteries were what sunk that on the PCA side.
Well, it's interesting you mention, you know, the figure of Francis Schaeffer, and rightfully so, but the one we didn't mention is not the exclusive reason. Part of it has to do with the thoughts about the OPC being separatist or cold or doctrinaire and not having warm hearts for evangelism, which I dispute, but I understand the characterization. But also the figure of Norman Shepherd and all of the struggles over the doctrine of justification going on at Westminster Theological Seminary and within the OPC at the time really scared quite a few PCA people away as well.
Well, as my friend, my associate Mark Harrington says, there's the real reason and the public reason. I think the Shepherd controversy was the public reason. I think some people who just didn't want to do that, although Palmer Robertson, I know, was genuinely concerned for theological reasons.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Some others, but here again, the Southerners jumped on that.
Yeah,
the Southerners who didn't want merger with the OPC said, "Look, they're not clear on justification."
Yeah.
So
it's convenient.
That was the real reason.
Yeah.
The public reason is usually not stated. So we're as Presbyterians, we're very gifted to draft any soundbite that will support our argument, particularly at General Assembly. So that's another caveat. People will say things that they would never own up to in any other forum, and will argue vehemently at Presbytery as well in General Assembly to win an argument. There are political motivations underneath.
Sure.
And we should, here again, I hope we'll be honest about this. Mm-hmm. To me, good men are free to differ, but it seems to me more progress would be made if there are disputes or important things to consider. If we would be honest about the basis of our opinion, then than be arguing about secondary matters.
Sure. I love that. Thanks for that. Carlton, do you have any final questions or comments?
I just appreciate your zeal for open and public debate on these matters. And I'm thankful for the PCA, but I'm thankful as well for the experience of men who've been in the PCA much longer than I. So just appreciate your ministry and thankful for this book.
Thank you. Amen. Well, let me just say too, it's very encouraging to me. You guys are younger men, and I think the future of the Reformed Church is bright with leaders like the two of you and others. And I'm very grateful for your hard and faithful work. And I commend you both for that.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. We appreciate that. I'm very thankful for your work and also very hopeful that more fruit will come from the reading and the contemplation of this book. And that goes for everyone who may read it, whether people appreciate all the points or not. I think it's a worthy title, and I'm really happy that you're able to join us today to speak about it. Thanks for writing it, but thanks for talking with both of us today on the matter. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah. I want to point people to the various websites and other resources, and of course, to the episode description on our site, where we'll have links to all the pertinent things, including a way to get a copy of the book that we're talking about today, Irony in the Presbyterian Church in America. It's available on Amazon and other spots as well. There's a link there that you can click. And head on over also to Midway PCA. We'll have a link there. And Westminster PCA, if you happen to be in the Atlanta area, you can visit all sorts of excellent good churches and visit Dr. Hall, Dr. Wynn. And call me up if you're going down there. Maybe you can take me along and we'll go visit. I was there, in December. I'd love to be back soon. It's always a good place to be. And we're online at reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, our courses, and other publications. Good stuff coming up in the near future. This year, we've got a lot of books in the works, so we're happy to share them with you and tell you about them as well. And we want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.